You are listening to KHSU. Thanks for tuning in to Thursday Night Talk. This week, Brenda Starr is our host. As always, we welcome your contributions. Please give us a call at 826-4805, or if you're out of the area, at 1-800-640-5911, and to our text message line at 492-KHSU. Now over to Brenda.
Well, thank you, Michael. Yes, good evening. This is Brenda Starr, and I'm here in the studio with Doc Stuhl. And it's our, well, if it's July, it's our annual sports talk review. I don't know if you got a chance to see on the homepage of KHSU is a lovely little graphic that we now have for our annual meeting here.
I did see that.
And then you came dressed.
The absence of gray hair in the graphic. I appreciate that.
And so we're in for an hour of storytelling, rhythm. Doc and I share a lot of passions, and I always have the best time with you.
Me too. It's a great tradition. Thanks for having me back.
I even brought the hats today.
You did.
East Coast, West Coast. Anyway, Doc, if you don't know, is a storyteller, an adventurer, a writer, a professor, a musician, radiophile, jazzman, and so much more. I always think of the word Renaissance man. And, you know, we've been using that word for decades. And it's not as if you accumulate all those things on purpose to become that. It's the adventure of your life that unfolds that brings you that moniker. And it really does. So welcome, Doc.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much.
For those of them out there, listeners who do not know who you are, Richard Erland Doc Stuhl, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up in the Bay Area. And had wonderful influences there, Berkeley, and grew up in a place in the Berkeley Hills where you could literally see both bridges, and had a lot of interesting friends from interesting walks of life, particularly the university parents and whatever. My parents were fascinating folks. My mother was actually a professional singer and professional. Went to the American Conservatory in Chicago, had a career there, had a career in San Francisco, and extremely disciplined and imperious. So she wasn't easy. And my dad was kind of a Renaissance man. He came from Ohio, but came from a very, very interesting family. But my dad was a musician. He was a terrific public speaker. He wrote a book on humor. He was a minister at one time. He really did it all. But he was actually a very humane, gentle person, and I really identified with my dad. My mom was a tough one. I went to school at UC San Diego at a very interesting time. I was in the communications department there, which was a, you know, very, very political department. I was there between 72 and 76, so I had some very, very interesting influences at UC San Diego, which was kind of an up-and-coming UC campus at that time. My best buddy actually left and went to work for Al Gore when he was first elected to Congress and called me and said, you know, Dick, you should come to Washington, D.C., because this guy is going to be president one day. And he was almost right.
He did win the popular vote.
He did win the popular vote. That's right. And actually, what's very interesting is that my best buddy, when I was at UC San Diego, his specialty was science, technology, and public affairs and environmental science, and he was one of the legislative assistants when Gore first got to Congress that turned him on to big environmental issues. So that was interesting. And I actually went out to D.C. and joined my buddy out there. I bartended, and I wound up going in a different direction, but had a great time at UC San Diego, and then I came out here. And it was actually in response to a personal tragedy, and I wanted to remake myself. I enjoyed Washington, D.C., and actually had plans to go to American University, and I was offered an internship for Voice of America, which in retrospect, of course, I would have loved doing because I had the radio voice then, and I loved the rhythms of radio, and I was very interested politically. I left out that I had studied in Europe and in Germany and France and traveled all over the world, too, above the Polar Circle and Israel and Turkey. This is 1974 and 75, and then I went to D.C. But then I came to Humboldt County, and I didn't know anybody. And I got a job. It's not extant anymore, but the planing mill, Simpson, the dry sorter, and started out there, and it was – it was just a whole new experience. But growing up, I was a big Jack London fan, and it was all about the experience and the adventure. And I thought, well, isn't this something? And so I went and pulled Green Chain in the lumber mill for 3 years and decided to get a master's. And I wanted to be physical. I was tired of the intellect, and I just wanted to start afresh. And so I got a master's in physical education and pulled Green Chain and lumber mill. Just completely different from everything I had done before. But I looked upon it as kind of a writerly experience. And my mantra always when I was traveling was that there was part of me that was looking down on myself. And I would say, well, now, isn't this interesting? And I think I was adventurous by nature anyway. But I always told myself, well, I got to do it so I can write about it and tell these stories later. And so that impelled me and compelled me to take a lot of chances with my life in terms of adventure. I think it was adventure that I was looking for. That's what compelled me the most was to take a chance. If it was about romance or adventure, I was willing to do it. So.
Well, you like to talk about how you use all five of your senses, which I like to say is psychedelic. I mean, that's the actual definition of psychedelic, using all your five senses. I know your influences, like you say, was Jack London.
Yeah.
You're a docent down there.
Yeah, that's right. I'm actually doing a reading in 2 weeks at Jack London State Park on the 12th, which is a Saturday, August, on one of his lesser-known short stories called War. Which is a fascinating, this is, of course, you could actually see it as an anti-war theme, but most people don't know Jack London wrote that. But anyway, I left out. After I came to Humboldt, I taught dance here with Kay Chafee, longtime professor
what
here.
What kind of dance?
I did it all. I did square dance. I did ballroom dance. I actually took a year of ballet.
Wow.
When I was here, while I was pulling Green Chain at the lumber mill, you know.
Oh, wow. I want to see you do a plié.
Yeah, that's
right. Here.
Well, I didn't perform that in the break shack with my Portuguese buddies from the Azores. I can tell you that. But in any case, I actually got very interested in the physics of human performance, which, again, was a completely different thing. Went on to Northern Colorado, got a doctorate, taught back east, actually taught race walking classes at the Department of Justice and the Treasury Department. While I was looking for a job, I sold myself. I had just gotten my degree. And so we would go race walk out on the steps there in front of the Capitol, and we called it wogging. And so I'd actually forgotten that, but I've had a lot of coffee, and it just came back. a neuron just flashed, and then I thought, wow, yeah, I did that too. You know, wave to, let's see, who was there when I was there? I'm trying to think now. Who was Perez? I guess it was George H. No, it was Ronald. It was Ronnie.
Ronnie.
Yeah, it was Ronnie. He was looking out the window. And then I came back here and was on the faculty here for 23 years, taught biomechanics, but I also sang vocal jazz and did a book show. So I was just very interested in the university as a place where I could continue to learn in a lot of different disciplines. And I took classes while I was a professor here. So I probably had a very unorthodox career because I was doing a lot of different things. I taught Tai Chi for 23 years out on the plaza in front of the theater here. So I really, I made it work for me. You know, I saw the university literally as, it was like a symphony. I was conducting a symphony and I had all these different possibilities and could do it. And I just didn't want to confine myself to one little parochial discipline, and so I tried to make it work, and I did. I love teaching. I love the performance. I enjoy the students very much.
What did your biomechanical students think of you at the time? Because I'm sure you were all over the place as far
it was
a tangent here and a tangent there.
Well, the sports really came in handy because most of the textbooks were basically like physics books, but they were just looking at mechanics. But what I would do to make it exciting was I would take like a great play at the plate, or, you know, does somebody really hit a ton when the ball hits the bat, or, you know, when George Foreman knocked out, or when Ali knocked out Foreman in the Rumble in the Jungle, you know, what was the force of the punch? And then I would show it And then we do the calculations on the board. And I didn't know anybody who did that. And when I was back at Northern Colorado, nobody did that. So I got them engaged with the stories, and then I talk about the event, and then I go, let's see what really happened there. And so then, of course, that led into kind of cultural analysis, and they would ask questions like, well, did you really see that? And then I'd give them the cultural background. And then what happened, I think, is that kind of – I became kind of known for that. That, you know, it wasn't just math and whatever. It, you know, I became known for bringing in all these other social things. And then I eventually kind of went back to that, you know, those kind of social disciplines in the latter part of my career. And, you know, I was always interested in writing and poetry. And I did poetry at the Jambalaya for 10 years. I went to the open mic there and did that. And I did a lot.
Well, what you brought a poem with you, actually, that you said you wrote.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Well, this was my first boxing poem.
That's what I'd like to hear. I'd like to hear.
Yeah,
that.
I wrote this, I think, when I was either a sophomore or a junior at Palo Alto High, and I actually went to Las Vegas with my high school English teacher to see Muhammad Ali fight Jerry Quarry when I was 16 years old. That's a great story, isn't it? You couldn't do that today.
I know.
But this is a poem I wrote. So here it is. It's called Prize Fighter. Taped hands, primitive fury, gloved in 8 ounces of civilization, hang loosely beside bronzed body, glistening in the glare, jouncing, jabbing, stalking, swaying, weaving, bobbing, lithe and lethal in the light, filtered through cigar smoke. The boxer awaits the bell, nostrils flaring, breath steaming, poised to loose once again man's sublimated savagery. Sweaty, bloody, bruised brow exchanged for the fighter's prize.
Yes.
Well, that was my 16-year-old attempt at...
I hear the speed bag right there.
That's right, the purr of the bag. get it purring like a kitten.
Well, you know, boxing is something that, you know, especially a lot of women will think, you know, it's a very violent sport. We know that. We understand that. Yet there's something very compelling about it, and it's an artistry in itself, and it is poetry and artistry.
Oh, no question.
You know, you and I have talked about boxing. I started, my grandfather liked boxing, but mostly he liked wrestling. And in the 60s, you know, some of the wrestling back there, Chief J. Strongbro. Now, this guy came out with the full regalia and stuff. I never really knew if he was actually Native American or not. Bruno Sammartino, was one of my grandpa's favorite. Pedro Morales, Tony Marino.
Pat Patterson, Ray Stevens, the Mongolian Stomper, the Iron Claw,
Argentina Apollo. That was my favorite. He was so beautiful.
And
I would practice this. I would practice this move out in the backyard, where I'd get up and you'd have to, and you would fly with both your legs. Foo, foo. And then my mother finally said, "Would you like to put a mattress down there for you?" Because I have over all these decades, my body now is falling apart from all those silly things that we do.
Do you remember Gorgeous George?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
You see, that his shtick.
Oh, yeah.
Ali watched him
and
got the bombastic, you know, flair from Gorgeous George.
Right. The Undertaker. I mean, that guy.
The Undertaker.
And Haystack Calhoun.
Yep.
Talk about a big man.
Yeah.
So that was that in roller derby.
Right. And that was very big in San Francisco. That's exactly right.
Bay City Bombers.
Joni Weston and the Bay Bombers. Yeah. So it was KBHK, I think, as I recall. It's like Channel 44, and you got the VHF. They had the little wire on your TV, and my parents, you know, didn't, you know, wanted me to do my homework and whatever, and I'd have to sneak out there late at night, and I could watch, you know, roller derby and professional wrestling.
So, that's right. Yeah. For all you youngsters out there, Doc and I grew up with, what, 3 channels, maybe then moved to 6, then a UHF, and, look at us now.
Now
I could watch. I'm at the beach the other day, and the Giants are playing a day game, and I could look and see, you know, on a little thing what the score was. My friend was at the game, and I pretended like I was watching it on TV, and I'm having a good time at the beach. So, you know, some things we've given up.
True.
And some things have gotten better.
Well, interesting that you mention that, because some of my most joyous memories, and I think if I could come back and and have another life. I did it in a sense with my kind of my ESPN sports history thing that I did, but I love the great announcers, and I grew up with Russ Hodges, who of course did the New York Giants, and Lon Simmons, and Don King. I don't know if you remember him, boy, he was like a machine gun, and I love listening to him do the Warriors and the Raiders. But there was nothing better, you know, than going out and mowing the back lawn in July or August, and it was hot, and hearing Russ Hodges, you know, this is, you know, 62, 63, you know, and listen to the ball game on the radio. That was really, really fun. And it was interesting, last year during the World Series, I was in Bolivia, of all places, and I was there for 3 months. The only American I met in Bolivia, it was one of the last weeks I was there, and we listened to the seventh game of the World Series on the radio. He was an old-time guy. He didn't want to watch it on my computer. He wanted to hear the broadcast. So we listened to it. We could have watched it, but we were both kind of reliving our past. And it was fun hearing the Chicago announcers. And his name escapes me now. He's a very famous Cubs announcer. You would know the name. I can't remember. But we listened to the call of the game on the radio. So here we were in Tarija, Bolivia, in the heart of the Bolivian wine country, and we're listening to the Cubs and the Indians and called on the radio. It was great.
Sports in the world. You're listening to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. I'm Brenda Starr, your host this evening, and in the studio is Doc Stoll. And we are enjoying our annual Sports Talk Review. You can join in on the conversation with a comment, story, or question by calling us at 707-826-4805. Toll free at 800-640-5911. If you're shy, don't want to be on the air, if you were the person who played right field, you can text us at 492-5478. And our engineer, Michael, will read them on the air. We welcome you. So, yes, talk up. All over the world. Now, you know, we have, let's see, my love, of course, is baseball, because when I grew up, baseball was it. It was really before basketball or hockey had become popular. Football was always kind of popular. But still, the rest of the world revolves around soccer.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, being in Latin America, I was in one of the three countries, I think, in Latin America where soccer isn't the ascendant sport, but in Bolivia, who they have one of the worst teams ever in Latin America, soccer is still king, and it was a blast. I really, really enjoyed it, and I liked it as a kid and actually played it. I played it in junior high, but when my son John was little, we watched all the World Cups, and it was fun for him, and just the different colors and the different styles of play, and you would impute certain cultural characteristics, you know, the machine-like, play of the Germans and the order and the samba creative Brazilians and whatever. So that was really fun, just the different nationality, even though the best players, of course, played professionally in other leagues, they would get back together every 4 years and represent their country. And and it is king. I mean, soccer is king. It's king. It is the world sport, without a doubt. And, lots of announcers still, I listen to sports announcers still disparage soccer, like what is this, you watch for however many minutes and it's 2-1 or whatever. But the lines and angles and movement of the game is really really captivating. And the older I get, the more I enjoy the game.
What I find interesting now is watching things, fast-forwarding them.
Mm-hmm.
I usually like to watch everything live, but you can't do that all the time. So every once in a while, I'll watch a game or something that, I'm interested in. And because I played, the strategy. Mm-hmm. I played field hockey, which got me acclimated to soccer.
Yeah.
Softball, which, baseball when I was little, but, you find all that. And then basketball. And I can even see the similarities in hockey. But when... When you fast forward it, you see everything happening.
That's a really good point. You're exactly right. It actually, in some ways, you're right. I'm trying to think of an astute analogy, and I can't do it. But you're right. You see how it develops. When you're in it, you don't really see it.
And when you're watching live, You're caught up in maybe watching one player.
Right.
When you're doing fast forward, you can see, okay, that guy's okay. Here's he's coming up for the screen. It's just like kind of falls in, and your mind recognizes that, which I find interesting.
I think you pick up the patterns. You don't really discern the patterns, but if you do it quickly, all of a sudden there's a logic to it. You know, I mean, in retrospect, it happened. But then there was a logic to why the goal. It's like a Charlie Parker jazz solo.
Exactly.
And when they transcribed it, like I remember Wynton Marsalis talking about, and they said, well, you know, he was playing notes between the notes, and it was going nowhere. And then you transcribe it, and it had a harmonic consistency to it, that it wasn't just random notes. And I think it's similar, like when you're fast-forwarding the soccer game. Yeah.
And you bring up a point that I wanted to talk about, because I've had a couple of guests on, and one particular who's, you know, a musician, mm-hmm. and comes from a family of musicians and does not understand sports. And a lot of particularly women who I talk about, it's like, oh, you know, the competitiveness, this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And there's, to me, there's always an analogy there.
Absolutely.
And it's not so much, yes, there's things to learn. There's takeaways that are negative and takeaways that are positive. There's professional sports, which is a whole different animal than growing up playing.
Right.
Being able to, you know, play with each other, having to communicate, having to coordinate, having to share even equipment, and all of that, which comes in. And it does play very well with music, with the staccato.
No question.
Of life.
No, I totally agree. I mean, if you think about it, musicians are really small muscle athletes. So you know, there it is. I mean, I think Arthur Rubinstein could rip off 22 notes in a second or whatever. I mean, you can't tell me that a classical pianist is not an extraordinary athlete, you know, or a violinist who can play Paganini, you know, at that speed and with power and with feeling. So it's definitely that. But when you think about athletes are really body musicians, but they're kinetic chords, they're movement chords. So, you know, Michael Jordan, you know, or Kobe Bryant or LeBron James is to me very analogous to a Charlie Parker or someone in terms of dynamics and in terms of creativity, because it's you know, we're talking about jazz here, but that's what the great ones are. I mean, the great one-on-one players or the great players who can pass, like LeBron James or whatever. They're seeing lines and angles, and they're seeing – that's really the definition of genius is seeing – similarity and dissimilar things. You see patterns and you recognize it, and bang, you go. And that's the difference between a jazz genius and somebody who's just very good.
Right.
It's the same thing with art. You know, same thing. That's what Cezanne did. That's what Picasso did. They saw it in a different way. So I do see the analogies across the arts.
And when you were talking about teaching your biomechanics class, so you were way ahead of, remember when they did do, when Michael Jordan did the jam from the free throw?
Mm-hmm.
Boom, boom, boom.
Mm-hmm.
Now you would have had that nailed.
Right. Well, what's interesting is one of the things I did, for example, is it looked like, you know, he was moving, you know, horizontally, like he was literally flying, and I could explain that, like a ballet artist, for example, like a great there was a movie called Turning Point. You might remember back in 1971. And the greatest dancer of the day, Baryshnikov, you don't see him. And then from off stage, you see him jump. And it's just astonishing, the vertical leap that he had. The vertical leap that he had. But he literally looked. But it was the way he moved his arms and legs that gave the illusion of flight, which is what ballet teaches you.
Right.
And so it's very similar in a slam dunk. If you move your arms and legs, if you're moving up, even as you happen to be coming down on the apex, the illusion for sight is that you're moving across. And that's the kind of stuff I did in my class, which is really fun, which is another thing which is interesting, is that, you know, I was probably a better-than-average athlete. I was never great, but I loved it and played, and I tried everything. I took a year of ballet here at Humboldt State back in 1981. It was the single hardest physical activity I ever did. Nothing was more excruciatingly difficult or challenging for me. So I took two semesters. I don't know that I really got any better, but because – and the other interesting thing about ballet is that it's painful. If to do it right, you give the illusion of grace, and the better you are at that, the more pain it is.
Yeah.
Because your body really wasn't built to do that.
Right.
You know, that's why Isadora Duncan, you know, more than 100 years ago said, you know, this isn't a natural way of moving and whatever. And
well,
modern
just like
dance,
a pitcher, that's not a natural way for a motion for your arm either.
Right.
Lynn Swann.
Of course.
From the Pittsburgh Steelers,
right,
taken ballet.
Right.
Because he needed to move those muscles to contort in order to get the catch.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
And actually, like Herschel Walker, I think, you know, went back and took ballet training, and he partnered with the Houston Ballet and whatever. But to learn about your body in space,
mm-hmm,
analytically, I really learned a lot from taking that year of ballet, even though I was no good. But people were tolerant of me in class. So, yeah. So.
Oh, I wanted to talk a little bit about your parents, because you said that they gave you such good advice. Your mom had said to you, be the character in the song.
Yeah.
She's a singer. And your dad had said, you can make more friends giving a 20-minute speech. And you can exert more influence and make more contacts than if you lived in a community for over 20 years and didn't have the ability to speak before an audience. Those two things seem to really, they parallel your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really lucky there. I had pretty unusual parents. I was an only kid. My mom had me late. She had a stillborn before I was born. The doctor had said, this is the last chance. So I didn't have brothers and sisters. But my parents are both very, very unusual. My mom's gift was, and I watched her teach voice in our house every day. And she taught it very physically, and she always said, you know, what are you singing? And she learned a lot from the jazz singers, you know. She said, Billie Holiday's singing a song. I mean, you're feeling the pain. You're living the pain with her. That's what made her so good. She had a range of maybe an octave. You know, Ella had 4. You know, Billie had 12. But she could still, with that, she could make it feel. And my mom understood that. And so I saw her bring a lot of musicians out by thinking about the words that they were actually singing and trying to get in character. And that was a real gift that she had. So I kind of internalized that. And, you know, my dad also was an entertainer. He was a great storyteller. And I can actually remember parties that we'd have in our house in Berkeley or Palo Alto or whatever. And there'd be two groups of people. There'd be people crowded around my mom, and she'd be telling stories, and they'd crowd around my dad, you know. And I'd try to break in, like, you know, what about me? So, but, yeah, my dad, in terms of human psychology, I think the lessons about humanity I really learned from my dad. Yeah, I would go to San Francisco with him, and he would say, Dick, I'm going to give you the secret to life. You know, I'm 8 years old in the car sitting next to my dad, you know, and he, you know, we drive down Market Street, and he'd go, look at everybody out there. He said, everybody out there is wearing a big sign that says, I want to feel important. And if you don't forget that, you will be successful in life. Because, and that was a beautiful piece of advice. And that's the way he dealt with people. In a beautiful life, you know, James, you know, Jimmy Stewart, you know, some guy's mad and in the bar and whatever. And instead of taking it personally, he goes, well, sounds like you're having a bad day. You know, well, my dad was kind of like that. And he could really turn people around because he never took it personally. And I think that was a great piece of advice. And the speaking thing was really important. And I took it for granted probably. You know, they asked Michael Jordan, they said, when are you the most stressed? And he said, when I don't have the ball. And I felt like that. Like, give me the microphone. I'm stressed when I don't have it. But that's the greatest fear in the world, right, is getting up in front of an audience. So I was really given a gift by my parents, the ability to get out in front of an audience and like it and enjoy the storytelling thing. So I got that from my dad, too. And my mom was a performer. Here's what's interesting, Brenda. my mom was such a perfectionist that when she was truly in front of an audience, it never came out where she did it in practice. She was too kind of, whereas my dad never thought like that. And my mom used to tell me, you know what? If I had been born 20 years later, where I would have just wanted to be behind a curtain and sing, and I could get in the character and I could be angelic. But because the people were there, she never sounded like I knew she could sound. Whereas my dad, he liked it. He liked the pressure.
Interesting.
The more pressure, the better. He loved it.
Wow.
I'd see him do magic, and he would purposely fumble a card to set up even more tension, like he would pretend that he actually had blown the trick and everybody was going to wait for him to fail. He loved doing stuff like that. It's like a boxer hanging up against the ropes and having you throw a haymaker, and then you slip around, you throw a left hook to the liver, and it's over. You walk back. Yeah, well, my dad kind of saw it like that. So, it was fun. It was. I really learned a lot. I was very lucky. And they were good with my friends, too. They pass those things on.
Doc, if you put your headphones on,
sure.
We have a caller here. We have Tom from Arcata. Tom, welcome to Thursday Night Talk.
Thank you, Doc. It's a privilege to hear your voice. You may not remember me. You had me in a couple of your HED classes.
I do remember you, Tom, and I remember a lot of our discussions. You were actually in the Bay Area and Stanford, and I remember a lot of those things that we talked about.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. Well, you were probably the best teacher I had at HSU. And, the academic program for me was always a bit of a stress. But your other antics and shenanigans don't mean to be demeaning. But these are things that I used to do all the time as well. And listening to you and watching you play the guitar in class and everything was just soul-inspiring. Okay. Now, do you guys remember Pepper Gomez?
Oh, yeah, Pepper Gomez. Yes, from San Francisco.
Yes, Pepper Gomez, the wrestler, right, at the Cow Palace.
That's right? Okay.
Yes.
All right. A final thing here. You're getting shut down, I believe. Doc, when do you give your short little blips on what radio and what times?
Well, I'm with Danielle Orr on the Humboldt magazine, and it's usually the first Friday of the month, and I usually go on right after the news and the weather, about 1:05 or so. And then you probably
1:05 p.m.
Right on Fridays, the first Friday of the month. And the theme there is actually the Caribbean and Latin American sports and their connection to politics and popular culture. You know, I went down to Nicaragua and got an ESL degree and taught down there, and then went to Bolivia. And so I kind of wanted to keep my hand in that part of the world. And so Danielle and I have a lot of fun doing that. So that's when you can hear me on KHSU.
That would be on KHSU.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Doc, I want to tell you, you've talked frequently in your classes about your family. You actually are, what's the best word to say here? You are the son of your father. And your father, you said, was a Renaissance man, obviously. Well, you are as well.
Well, thanks. You know, the thing about fathers is when you're little, you go, I can never be that guy. You know, you don't think so, you know. So, So I never thought I could be that guy and measure up to my dad. I really looked up to him. And I did also just because of his humaneness. He wasn't an authoritarian or inspire fear. He just was a very gentle, wonderful man. I would hope that I would come up and equal that part of him, too.
Oh, yeah, you do. I can remember when my assignments were late, and you would give me a time to fill it in on the computer. But one thing you didn't know is I never knew how to work computers.
Oh, I, well, I, I didn't know that, Tom. That explains a lot. But yeah, thank God I was lenient, huh?
So, yeah, oh, very. Yeah. And I only found out that you had extended me time after the fact, months later.
Yeah.
And I, oh, damn! He's sitting here waiting for me. All right, Doc. Good to hear you, and the best of luck to you.
Well, thank you, Tom. I really appreciate talking to you, and I remember you very well. I really appreciate your calling.
Thanks, Doc. Okay. Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye.
Thank you. And Andy, welcome to Thursday Night Talk.
Yeah, good evening, Doc Stahl. This is Andy from the Courseware Development Center. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. All the stream guys, say hi.
Hey, say hi to the stream guys.
I will. Yeah, I'd love to be there talking Muhammad Ali and Frank DeFord with you, but my question is about Colin Kaepernick and the stance that he's taking.
Yeah,
I want to know, who do you think in current American sports society would do the most good standing alongside Kaepernick, echoing his sentiments?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. You know, there was such a fallout. And you know, when he did that, I went back. You know, Kaepernick was always a very thoughtful guy. He was an excellent student. You know, he probably always had that predilection. And, I remember a lot of people asking me about that. I admired him for that. And who knows, you know, what's going to happen. Who has kind of the moral gravitas to do that? I think LeBron James has done that somewhat, has stepped out and spoken out on social issues. Certainly it's a different time than Muhammad Ali. Michael Jordan had the opportunity too, but didn't. He never really took a hard political stance. So I'm not sure, you know, if I can answer your question, except that since we are in very, very pivotal times right now, sometimes it takes a symbol. Sometimes it takes just somebody to truly step up. And it's got to be the right person at the right time that has this kind of moral gravitas. And maybe there's somebody out there in the sports world who could do that. I don't know. But it might be time. You know, it might be time to do that. And I know from my own experience, because, you know, you remember me talking about Ali and growing up, you know, with those issues. The fact that a sports figure was talking about social issues when you're very young allows you to examine those issues, even when you may not have the history or maturity to truly understand it. They have credibility because you look up to them and they're an athlete. And I think that's what Ali did for a lot of, I mean, obviously I think he did it for Black America, but he did it for a lot of middle class kids too, especially when he was on the lecture circuit and he came to San Jose State, and you know, he gave lectures all over the country. So I don't know. I probably haven't answered your question, Andy, who that person might be, but I think there are probably certain athletes out there at a peak level who potentially at the right time, and we're there. I mean, I think we're teetering where people who have moral gravitas need to start taking a stand. And obviously, not to get too political here, but there have been few in the Republican Party who have done that. Maybe it needs to come from the outside. I don't know, to get the momentum swinging in the other direction. So,
well, I appreciate your words, and I look forward to hearing more from you.
Hey, great talking to you. Thanks for calling in. Say hi to everybody. Those stream characters.
Yep, that's us.
Okay.
Well, next year is the 50th anniversary of Tommy Smith's raising up black fist at the 68 Olympics.
Right.
And so I'm sure as it was last year. But next year, with anniversaries, we have a propensity to talk a little bit more about things.
Yeah,
and maybe, you know, admire people a little bit more.
Well, and of course, that's etched in my memory. And I read John Carlos's book with Dave Zirin about that. I remember that very well. Of course, you know, growing up, you know, in the vicinity of San Francisco State and whatever, and remembering that. It was a different time and a different era and a different set of circumstances, and look what happened to their careers.
Right.
God, I mean, and I think they're still outcast to some degree.
Well, look at Kaepernick's career. We just referenced him. You know,
right.
Maybe he'll get picked up by the Ravens. Maybe he won't.
Maybe. Yeah, but he obviously felt strongly about it, and you know, with his talent and where he was at the time, he had to have known, you know, I don't think he didn't know that potentially could be the end of it if he took that stand. So you have to admire somebody, you know, to do that. I mean, I think his eyes were open. I don't know if I would have had the courage to
do that. Apalook, as my grandmother would say, open mm-hmm. your eyes. Well,
yeah.
He also gave $1 million away.
I know. Yeah.
And maybe with thinking, well, I'll be making more so I can give this. This is
right.
an honest gesture. This is a huge honest gesture, even at his own, you know, at his peril of his own financial security.
Right. And, you know, somebody like Steve Kerr, for example.
Steve Kerr is a very good example. Somebody who
is, you know, an extremely thoughtful person. You know, his dad was an ambassador, who was killed. So, you know, he grew up in an environment where he had a better than average understanding of complex international affairs and whatever. And you know, he would – and an enlightened outlook. And he has spoken out, you know, about certain things. So Popovich – has.
I can name those. So, those are about the two coaches? Typically don't.
That's about all I can think of. I mean, you know, going back to our era, one of the things that surprised me about Vince Lombardi in retrospect was that how far ahead of the game he was on social issues in terms of gay players and in terms of interracial marriage and all kinds of things that were lightning points at the time, mm-hmm. particularly in football. And Lombardi was way ahead of the curve of other and is not really – I don't – when you hear the name Lombardi, you associate it with – conservative discipline and whatever, and yet he was a lifelong Democrat and felt the sting of, you know, of racial prejudice himself as an Italian American and never forgot it. So he was very sympathetic in that world. So he certainly stood out. You know, how long ago was that? Around 50 years ago, right?
So, well, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Well, if you're talking about, let's see, that first Super Bowl, right? I think we might have been in the single digits then.
Yeah.
But that's the thing about sports and often the military as well. They've been huge influences on opening up dialogue.
Yes.
So yesterday, you know, the president tweets about transgender not being able to serve in the military I guess he didn't realize there were, you know, many, many thousands who already are. But it does open up. Last year, when we were here, we kind of got bumped off of July. July is usually our thing. And we got bumped off because of the Republican National Convention. And so much has happened since then. Also, I think Caitlyn Jenner in that time was at the ESPYs.
Mm-hmm.
So we have in life these things in sports that can be held up because it's such popular culture.
Yeah.
Do you think it gives it a little bit more credence nowadays than it did before? Like we're talking about Tommy Smith. Between Tommy Smith and Caitlyn Jenner, you know, how far have we come? Or is it a constant, you know, 1-2 slide, 1-2 slide, 1-2 slide, 1-2 slide?
Yeah. I think it's maybe more the latter. I mean, when people like Bill Russell, for example, who, you know, grew up in Oakland and went to San Francisco State and was a very, very powerful voice, you know, back in the 60s for civil rights, Jim Brown spoke out. Probably had you know, it's hard to know. Did they have more to lose? Yeah, I mean, they were really taking courageous stands. But now, you know, you have this kind of miasma of commercialism. Mm-hmm. Like, Caitlyn Jenner is already suspect because Caitlyn Jenner's been involved in so many commercial kind of schlocky things. So there's the sheen is kind of off the moral gravitas on that, whereas she could make, potentially could have made a much more powerful statement. So that's it. It's hard to be an honorable person in a dishonorable world. And it's hard to maintain this thing we call character when everything about our lives is fodder for everyone else's discussion and abasement. And, of course, just looking at what's going on in our capital today, there is the, you know, the moral degradation and exemplar of it all.
But he's, let's see, Scaramouche, can you do the Fandango? Says, hey, he can throw a spiral through a tire. Right. He can hit a free throw, and he can hit a 3 or a 30-foot putt, but so can I. Yeah. And actually, with the football, I could do with either hand.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting. You were sharing before we got on air a story you wanted to tell about when you were in Bolivia and with politics and then returning home.
Yeah,
would you like to do that now?
Yeah, that really was interesting. You know, I went there. I was in Sucre, which is this beautiful white colonial city that no one's heard of. I hadn't heard of it actually 2 years ago. And I took language classes there and lived with a Bolivian family for a month. And then I went to a place called Tarija, which is more southern Bolivia near the Argentinian border. And it's the heart of the wine country. And I took intensive Spanish lessons down there. And I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed the Bolivians. It was a very kind of unique, almost a Wild West type experience. It was very different. It's 60% indigenous. I learned a lot about the indigenous culture there. It was just so different than anything. I had been in Nicaragua the year before that, so that was different. Maybe that prepared me for Bolivia. But I was there watching the run-up to the election, and then I was in Bolivia the night of the election and stayed up late and was listening to, you know, the call on the election, and I happened to be entertaining two Bolivian friends. So I had to explain to them in Spanish. This was the test of my newly acquired Spanish. What happened here? And that was quite a, I mean, to explain it in English at the time when it happened would have been a big mountain to climb, but to try to explain it in Spanish. And then it was so interesting because wherever I went, to cab rides or if in a restaurant or something, they would obviously know that from my accent and my limited vocabulary that, you know, I was either from the States or Canada or Europe. People usually guess the United States way down the line because you just didn't see that many Americans in Bolivia. But then, like, the waiters would bring their friends over and introduce me and then want me to explain what happened. But when I flew back, I remember flying over Coyote Point, and I'd done this so many times throughout my life, and I always felt like when those wheels touched down, that I was home somehow. And it was this visceral, sensual feeling that when those wheels touched down, I was in a different world. And I had never felt like that before. I knew everything was different, and it was a very eerie feeling,
kind of like a 9/11 moment.
I felt like literally I was in another country. The unpredictability of it, and will my son have the same kind of life that I had, all of the assumptions. It's one of those things where it's a psychologically traumatic thing when assumptions that you had never even questioned or considered before are all of a sudden, they're not there. So that was a really, really powerful experience that I never thought I would experience in my life. And I was, you know, my father shared with me his experiences in Europe. He was with the top secret civil affairs unit. He spoke colloquial German. He was an expert in German arts and monuments. He spoke colloquial German. He was an interviewer for sending people to the Nuremberg trials. He liberated 3 concentration camps and got 4 Bronze Stars, which he never talked about. Mm. And he talked a lot about tyranny and authoritarianism and racism and anti-Semitism. And he talked about these things with me. And I had a girlfriend when I was in Europe whose father was German, her mother was Latvian. Her father had been an adjutant to Erwin Rommel, who was one of the great German generals in World War II and escaped to Latin America like many ex-Nazis. And she actually divorced her father. As a child, she went to the courts and divorced her father. But she told me, and this is when we were in school together in Germany, she told me in 1974, she said, "You Americans think you're so special and you're so judgmental about Germany." And she said, "You wait, you are no different than anyone." I remember that as clear as a bell, her telling me that. It's chilling. And that was 43 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That she
everything
told me that.
Everything old and, is new again.
Right. And I had heard these stories from my dad, and here I was, you know, somebody who, and she, you know, like most people from Germany that I have met, you know, particularly young people, there's a you know great amount of collective guilt about that, and you know, and it's not their fault. It burned, but I experienced that as an exchange student over in Germany, and she felt the same way. But she also was politically savvy enough to think that you know you're naive, and you know, and in our book group, you know, we read Sinclair Lewis's, you know, it can happen here, and. And it's interesting, and you have a nice intellectual discussion about it, and then all of a sudden, here we are. It could happen here. Jack London wrote The Iron Heel, you know, which was about years of progressive thought and then a long revolution to try to, you know, regain what had been won because of an oligarchic, you know, takeover. So now all these things aren't just literary portentions to
right.
the future. It's you know we're here on the precipice here,
and we're getting ready to jump.
I feel that way. Yeah. You know, given my own background and education and people like this, you know, very brilliant, you know, girlfriend I had in Germany who had her own history with that and my father's experience in the war.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have another caller, Terry. I'll get to you in a second here. I just wanted to talk about one thing that you mentioned, Mr. Shep. I was listening to him on the radio not too long ago, mm-hmm. and he was talking about how even our sports games are different now. Mm-hmm. It used to be we were all in that stadium together. We're all as one.
Yes.
And that's even changed,
absolutely.
And that's a big difference now. Okay,
yeah,
Terry from Freshwater.
Yeah.
Welcome to Thursday Night Talk. Terry, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Welcome.
Listen, I don't even want to interrupt this. It's so good. I just wanted to send Doc, Terry Roloff.
Hey,
from
Terry.
Fisheries from, hi. You know, Doc, getting a chance to hear your backstory, I had no idea. I've been an admirer of yours. I hear you with Danielle Orr various times. Getting your backstory is amazing. I just can't believe sort of the breadth of your knowledge and interest and whatnot. And sometime we should meet at Brio or someplace, and we can talk about this stuff. But I'm going back to Kay Chafee and the book you wrote about her. And anyway, let's meet sometime.
Yeah, well, thanks, Terry. It's really, yes, I would love to do that. I appreciate your kind. Yeah, that would be really fun. Yeah, I'd love to. All right. Thanks very much.
Bye.
So before we go, I wanted to talk a little bit about the passing of some people that we typically do around this time. You and I went back and forth around Ruth Mountain Grove.
Yes.
One of your one of your poetry friends.
Yep. Yeah, we were at the Jambalaya together many times. Yeah.
You know, she was an old KHS shoer. Passed on earlier this year, Walter Natzler,
yes.
Who, of course, when Frank DeFord died, I thought, you know, Walter Natzler, Frank DeFord, were they ever seen in the same room together? Both
right.
Just incredibly handsome, nappy gentlemen. And then Lance Hardy.
Yeah.
You wrote a poem for Lance Hardy. I was wondering if you could read that.
Yeah, I did. Thanks. I appreciate your letting me share that. Lance and I, we were co-founders along with a theoretical mathematician named Joe DeRue of the North Coast Book Discussion Group, and Lance and I became very close. We did the first radio shows of Classics Now together and would take long walks. He was a very unusual character, but his voice was very distinctive. I remember he did Scrooge in a radio play, and it was perfect. His voice was really, he was a great literary character, you know. He was from Argentina. His name was Alejandro. Nobody knew that because he came out here and changed his name and changed his life. But here's the poem. To my friend Lance, a.k.a. Alejandro, un amigo, my friend, and confidant del mundo. It would be unlike you to see yourself honored in such a forum, and yet so like you, this Arcata Renaissance quorum, because you, Lance, were a voice, a friend, though an enigma, a mentor, an example, so present yet a mystery, a figment, un hombre sin judgment, un hombre con corazón, un hombre with wisdom, an exemplar, como un padrón. You had wit con wisdom, an intellectual's brew. Yet you understood yours and our perfections, too. You, a small boy in Mendoza, Argentina, un ciudad in the Andes, God's wine, country del sur. And you chose to be with us, still in our heart, to be sure. A mind with great yeast, wisdom for the ages, you live many lives, always seeking, never stopped turning the pages.
Beautiful. Such a sweet homage. So 50 years from now, who's going to be writing a poem for you?
Who knows?
Now, you had a little something that you wanted Michael to play for you. Should that kind of like be our bump out?
Or yeah, we can do it if you want. I mean, it's just
How
kind of a fun...
It?
Oh, it's not very long. You know, I had done a thing for the Sons of Italy on Joe DiMaggio. And, of course, DiMaggio's a local guy. Grew up in San Francisco, you know, actually played up here in Humboldt County.
Joey Diaz went to his funeral.
Right.
I had to do that.
But he was married to Marilyn Monroe, and Hemingway talked about him in The Old Man and the Sea. And of all the cultural icons in America, he would be there. So here's a little thing. It's Farewell, My Lovely. And it's about DiMaggio's streak in 1941, but Farewell, My Lovely was about the P.I. Marlowe. And this is Robert Mitchum's narration. Hopefully I can find it here. Yeah, okay, so give me a little noir music here. We'll go out on that. This past spring was the first time that I felt tired, and I realized I was growing old. Maybe it was the rotten weather we'd had in L.A. Maybe it was the run of cases I had. Mostly chasing a few missing husbands and then chasing their wives once I found them in order to get paid. Or maybe it was just a plain fact that I am tired and growing old. And the only real pleasure I had at all was following Joe DiMaggio, belting the apple out at an incredible clip for the New York Yankees. Well, it's the middle of July in the spring. And if I wasn't holed up in a dingy hotel... ducking the police.
And 56 will never be broken.
So there you go.
There you go.
Well, DiMaggio is a cultural hero I always always loved because and he touched so many different parts of society, and he was a classy guy.
So are you, sir.
Oh, thank you.
So are you. I really want to thank my guest here, Doc Stoll. Listen to Doc or to read his stories. Doc Stoll appears every month on KHU's Humboldt homepage with host Daniel Orr on the first Friday of the month. He also wrote a book, Muhammad Ali's Robe. You can find that. I'd like to thank our callers, Tom, Andy, Terry, our engineer, Michael, and you, the listener. Until next time, peace, frog.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Brenda Starr, and to our guest, Doc Stoll. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org. And like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Eric Kirk is our host next week. Thanks to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My